You're listening to The Dice Men Cometh, proudly sponsored by Area 52, Tasmania's largest independent pop culture retailer. Find them at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, or online at area52.com.au.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Good evening, everyone. It's Thursday evening, and that means it's the Dice Men Cometh here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Australia's leading tabletop board gaming
podcast,
all sorts of fun type gaming podcast and radio show going live to air. And Garth.
Hello.
There's an empty seat there.
I know, isn't it great?
Again.
Yeah, we just can't get enough of Leon not being here.
I don't know.
Hopefully he'll bother to turn up. Yeah, I know. So hopefully next week he'll actually bother to turn up because he's played quite a lot of games and recently held another one of his Silver Bullet Society werewolf
nights.
Yes,
that's right.
So he needs to tell us all about that. But anyway, that's next week's problem.
Ah, that's right. Well, look, I'll tell you what, I've got some exciting news.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, and I'm going to talk about it tonight in my exciting news segment.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah. I have got one game to talk about, Mark, that is going to rock your world.
Really?
Yes, because it combines several of your favourite things.
Woohoo!
No, not woohoo, choo-choo.
Oh, yes, baby.
Because we are going to talk a bit of a train game later after we do this introduction and throw to a song, I guess, aren't we?
Yeah, well, look, you're listening to episode 230 on the 20th of September 2018 here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. And thanks so much to our great sponsor, Area 52 at 104 Elizabeth Street, Hobart, who are Tasmania's leading pop culture retailer with board games, card games, manga and anime. I never can tell if those two are different, but anyway. books, cards, comical books, all sorts of things. If you're a lover of pop culture, get in and see the team there at Area 52. Now, until Leon comes, I better find one of these short two-minute tracks. It's going to take us to a break and bring us back. We'll be back in a moment here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. That was the, I'd have to say the dulcet tones. The dulcet tones of Billy Bragg. I think Wilco were also involved there. Ingrid Bergman. And that was off the, I can't remember the name of the album, but it was basically Woody Guthrie had all these lyrics that he'd written that had never been put to music or not that anyone had known. And his, I think his widow and his daughter basically hand-selected Billy Bragg and Wilco to put all these poems or a bunch of these poems to music. They actually released two albums of them.
Well, there you go.
There's some awesome little tracks on there. And I have to say, I'm a huge Billy Bragg fan. I've seen him, I think I've seen him three times out in Australia. Luckily, two of those times he's come here to Hobart, so can't wait for you to come back. Billy! You're in Edge Radio 99.3 FM with, not the Billy Bragg fan club, but the Dice Men Cometh. Now, Garth.
Yes?
I hear you're going to talk about one of my favourite subjects.
That's right.
A train game.
We are talking train games, and not just any old train game. Potentially the trainiest train game to ever train a train.
Yes.
According to several people, including yourself,
yes,
actually.
That's right.
Now, what started happening on our Thursday night's post-show game?
Yes.
Is we head back to Trent's house.
Yes. The Trent man cave.
Go to the man cave. And it's an alternating week of who gets to choose what game goes on.
Yeah, we've got our rotating roster of sort of five or six board game villains.
Correct. And last week it was your choice and you chose Railways of the World.
I did.
Under one very strict instruction in that you didn't have to teach Railways of the World.
That's right.
So what is this train game? Well, it is in fact a train game that is a re-implementation of previous train games, but more importantly, it's a Martin Wallace train game.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Now, it is essentially, for me anyway, the first real heavier train game that I've played. And, you know, I can't say that I've played Ticket to Ride, so I don't know how heavy that is. Might be in the same category as this.
Not quite.
But the map we played was the England and Wales map.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic because it is designed primarily for 3 to 4 players. We played it as 4.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very condensed map, which makes life easier for people who haven't necessarily played a Railways of the World train game before.
Yes, and look, you know, there are... Oh, I wouldn't be exaggerating if I said squillions of maps for Railways of the World. I mean, a heap of fan ones, but Eagle Griffin Games, who published this game, I'm pretty sure they still publish it. Yeah, they have got heaps of expansions. I think there's even an Australian map.
There is. They've just announced, or they've just done a Nippon expansion, so there's Japan.
It's
so there's
clearly very popular.
Yeah, so what is this game that we're talking about? Well, it's all about the early days of train travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess for the England and Wales map, which is the only map that I've personally played, it's set in the 19th century and it's basically where all of the tramways that were carting goods around various parts of the UK and Wales were being upgraded to trains.
Yes.
And those tramways became ultimately, thematically in the game anyway, under the control of 4 rival train companies, which is where the player count comes mm-hmm. into it. Now, this game takes up a lot of space.
Yeah, they're big boards, that's for
they
sure.
They are really big boards, but the boards themselves are quite easy to understand. You'll lay them out, and in this case, it'll have a lovely big map of England, and it will be dotted with all the various major and not-so-major cities. Yeah. So you'll have your Londons and your Manchesters and all of those, you know, well-known cities on the map.
Liverpool.
And then you'll have a whole bunch of not-so-well-known cities, which can make life a little bit trickier the track.
At least for us.
Yes.
Southern hemisphere types.
Correct. So you'll set up the map. Everyone's going to take a colour full of all of their beautiful little plastic trains. You're going to be able to get, I guess, a Baron card?
Yes, or
and,
rail barons.
And you get a couple of Baron cards, which are essentially just the way it's going to help you guide your strategy for the game, because these are all going to be some end-game bonuses yeah. that you'll be able to achieve if you've met the criteria of your particular Baron mm-hmm. card. And there might be Baron cards that say, well, if you connect these 2 cities together with rail of your network, then you'll get some bonus points. Or if you are able to upgrade your train the most, you'll get certain number of points. Or if you control a certain number of train lines, you will get X number of points. And they're all great because they do offer a lot of replayability, but they also offer you a direction, which is very, very handy for a new player when all you've got is a map full of cities that you're trying to connect.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously one of the things you have to do is you have to deliver goods.
Correct.
In the form of wooden cubes. And what makes it nice and easy is the red cubes have to be delivered to a red city. The blue cubes to a blue city, the black cubes to a black city, and so on and so forth.
And I love how you use the word easy, because this game isn't incredibly easy, because it's one of these games where you start with absolutely zero. And by that I mean you have no money,
mm-hmm.
you have no railway tracks, you've got no trains on those railway tracks, although you've got plenty of little plastic pieces to make them be trains, but you've got nothing to start with. So you are going to start this game in debt, because the very first action on the very first turn, on the very start of this game, is that you're going to go into an auction to determine first player. And that sounds amazing. I love this little mechanic to determine first player, because it's all about who wants it more, who thinks that, oh, if I get this little bit of advantage, I'll be ahead. But it's immediately then how much in debt am I willing to go for this bonus? And that's going to be happening quite a lot of times during this game, because this particular game, it will end when there are a certain number of depleted cities, cities that don't have any more goods on them. And the way the game will start is that you'll seed the map randomly just with cubes out of a bag, and there could be cities that have 2 cubes or 3 cubes, depending on, again, the size of the city.
Yeah.
So you're going to start this auction, which means that whoever wins it has to immediately take some shares.
Some bonds, isn't it?
And they are then going to cripple your engine building, because at the end of every round, for every bond you have, you've got to pay $1,000 back.
And this, it must be said, this is the best kind of debt, really, as far as the banks are concerned.
Yes.
This is debt you never, ever pay back. You just keep paying interest. In this game, it is basically $1,000 per bond, per round.
So you take that $5,000 loan that you need, but ultimately over the course of the game, you might have to pay back $5,000 or $10,000 on that. So that's the very first one. You'll decide who's going to be the first player. Play will then continue clockwise around the table, and it's an all or nothing bid. Once you you start with your opening bid, everyone can go up, but you've always got to increase the last bid. If you pass, you cannot go back into it. However, there is certain strategy in that, because once the first player or whoever wins the auction has won, play's going to go around clockwise. Yes. So you can sort of gain that a little bit, which is great. I think I really like that. So once that's determined, you're going to go into the meat of the game, which is the actions. And each round, you are going to have three actions to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll go, Mark gets an action, then whoever's next, and whoever's next, and whoever's next, then Mark will get his second action.
Yep.
And that'll go around three times for each round. On your turn, you can only really do three, four things.
Yeah.
The first one is you're probably going to build some track. And that sounds great, because you're going to need to build track to get your engines moving, to get your deliveries going. But you want to guess what, Mark?
Let me think. Track costs money.
Track costs money.
Yes.
And you've just taken a bond out to win the auction.
Yeah.
And now it's my first turn, and I've now got no money. All I've got is some debt.
I've got some negative money. I'll take some more negative money.
I'm going to take some more money to build a track. Now, this is important, because you will be building tracks. And the thing that makes, I guess, the England and Wales map a little bit different to a lot of the other ones is that on this map, there are 44 cities located.
Yeah, lots.
There are heaps, which means there are cities that can be connected with just one single piece of track.
Yeah.
And the way it works is each player is going to start with a level one train, which means it can only go one track. Not one track length, but between one city and another city.
Between two cities, effectively.
And as you upgrade your train will go to a level two, which means it can go from one city to another city, and to a three, to a four, all the way up to a level eight train. But at the start, you really need to make sure you're choosing very good cities to connect, because the only way you'll then actually be able to turn something into money to start building an economy is to deliver one good to one city as your action.
Yep.
Every time you do that, you'll be able to move your marker, which is another train, up the track, which will ultimately be getting you victory points. But initially, you're just going to be concerning yourself with how much income that generates.
Yeah, and that one cube is going to give you one up, move you up one spot. So it's a really slow, it's a grindingly slow start.
Is it ever? Because you might go from earning $0, you'll spend your first action building some track. Then if you spend your second action to deliver one cube, that might mean you will earn maybe $3.
Yeah.
And you're already in debt to the tune of $8 worth or what have you. So it's a really expensive little grind to get yourself going.
And I guess if you're lucky, you might be able to go in a city where you might be able to deliver, say, one cube either way or two cubes the same way, depending on, obviously, the colours of the cubes and the colours of the cities, because that's all random.
Yeah.
You might be lucky and score, like, 2 points and get that sort of $4,000 or $5,000 back.
But there are
one turn.
Yeah, but the good thing is there are these little bonuses. So as well as building track, you can upgrade your train. Now, you're not going to be doing that initially because to upgrade from a level one to a level two automatically costs $5,000, and who's got money for that?
Exactly. You could borrow some.
Of course you could. So you're probably going to build a track. You're probably going to deliver a good, but also you want to keep an eye on these operations cards.
Yes.
There are going to be a starting, what is it, 3 plus 2 per player in the game. So there's going to be a pretty wide selection. And there's a few different categories of cards. There are ones that are, as soon as you meet the criteria, you'll get a bonus.
Yeah, they're sort of automatic. You don't have to take them on a turn. You will qualify when you fulfill that thing. So
that's
you might be the first person to deliver, as I was, 4 different coloured cubes. You get that card and you get bonus points for that. Or you might be the first person to deliver a cube full stop, or the first person to go
to a certain city.
Yeah, or to upgrade to a level 3 train or something like that.
And they will give you normally an extra boost up that economy track. So instead of earning $3 per turn, you're going to be earning $5 or $6 or $7 or $8.
And
that's a really big windfall.
That's the thing. They were quite substantial because, you know, like an extra 3 points on that track could be an extra $5, $6, $7, $8. I mean, could easily double your income just with one of those cards.
So they're the couple of things that you can do. You can also, further on down the track do an action called Urbanize. Now, Urbanize essentially turns a grey city that doesn't want any particular types of goods. It's just a city that has goods and can send them off to coloured cities. You can upgrade that to a city of either blue or black or yellow.
Or purple, yeah. Anything purple. But red.
Anything
red,
but red.
Red is the... So, you know, like London was red, Manchester was red, a couple of other cities, like larger cities were red, yeah.
And that's kind of it. That's pretty simple what the game's going to do. Mechanically, there's not a huge amount to it. You're going to be building track and building train lines that you want to make sure you're keeping an eye on the coloured cubes, the colours of the cities that you have got control over, because as soon as you lay track, you own that. You don't need to worry about anyone coming in and taking over that particular line. But not after about, I guess, a half to a third of this game, there's going to be a very large mishmash. All different train lines going in all different directions, owned by all different people. And finally, they'll reach a point where everyone's upgraded their trains enough to be able to do these really good deliveries that might span over five different cities or more. But you'll have to share track to be able to do that.
Yeah, there's not many times you can get a sort of a four, five, six or more on your own track, unless you've invested a lot of money. And sometimes you do, like you double up where someone else has the same track. Because if you deliver a... you've got to have the first section.
Yeah, you own the first track.
To deliver, but then if you use any other person's track, you just have to give them, for each section they own, one of your points. So if you deliver a cube across six cities, but only, say, four of them were mine, one of those was yours, Garth, and one of them was Trent's, I get 4 points, Garth and Trent get one each.
Exactly.
And then when you get the dastardly thing, like, say, Trent might have a hotel, which there's a few of these event cards where you can you have a hotel in a certain city, and what that means is anyone who delivers a cube to that city has to give 1 point to the person who owns that hotel.
Yeah. So this game is really intriguing. For a trainy train game, which is very trainy because you're building the track and running the trains, you're delivering the goods, you'll be able to deliver further afield by upgrading your train, therefore increasing your train network. It is very thematic. This is fantastic. I really did enjoy my time there. But gosh, it can be pretty tough to figure out the math involved in this game.
It is quite a puzzle, and I think that's one of the things I like about this game is as you start, you're just looking, where can I get one or two links and start to deliver a few cubes over short distances to just get me moving on the income track. But once you get a bit of track out there, then you're starting to look and count, like, okay, I've got a red cube there. There's five cities away is a red city. Okay, I'm going to... Who else is competing in that city for me? Am I likely to get that one? Okay, and then I've got a purple four and another black one there that's four. Okay, if I can get my train to four fairly quickly, there's three or four or five cubes that I can deliver, and you can start to really race ahead on that income track. And it is one of those, I don't think you can plan too far ahead because you don't know what the track's going to look like, particularly in the first half of the game. So for me, someone who can't think more than you know, maybe a couple of turns ahead, and the turns are fairly short. You're not planning out these massive turns. It stays probably more at the tactical level than at the strategic grand overview level.
I certainly agree with that. And it also keeps it tight by very simply having the dual score track and income track, where you get to a certain point on the score track and your income starts to decrease.
Or it doesn't. Does it decrease or it just doesn't go? Yeah, no, it does
it
decrease. You're right,
decrease.
That's right.
So
which is a bit of a catch-up mechanic.
Yeah, so in the England and Wales map, the maximum that you can earn is about $24, $25.
Yes, that's right.
Which is where you're at the 30-odd victory point mark, and then it just starts going downhill. Mm. So you don't want to just try and deliver as quickly as possible because you're going to spend a bit of the game having your income just get whittled away and whittled away and whittled away.
Yes.
Now, this game is... so interesting, I find, because you are able to make those really interesting tactical decisions.
Yeah.
It's always making the best of the situation that you have on any given time. It is about making choices as, do I want to compete on a train line, or am I happy to divvy up the victory points as long as I am getting the most victory points?
Yes.
And you might say that, okay, I've got three out of the four tracks. I'll be able to make three. I'm giving one to my opponent, but hey, such is train life.
Yeah, and look, the rest of you, apart from Carl, I think, who had played this before with me, you guys didn't know about the other map. So the base map in this version, my version, I actually picked it up in a Bordercon math trade about four Bordercons ago, I think. And then I think maybe, oh, crikey, 3 years ago, I think I bought this expansion and it stayed in shrink until about a week ago. the board, and I did show you guys the massive, massive board that came with this version, which was the whole of the United States.
Yeah, North America.
I think in the newer versions by Eagle Griffin in Railways of the World, you get Eastern United States. And then another map is Western United States. You can get Canada as another map. Well, in this version, there was like three massive maps and they're all one. But what you found very much in playing that version was there's a little bit of competition in the northeast of the United States, you know, around Washington and New York and New England and all that sort of stuff. But then quickly people would spread out and you'd have people going west, people going northwest, people going south, people going southwest, and you didn't really interact very much because firstly you had these great big mountains in the way that you had to cross and it was really expensive, so you wouldn't want to waste any tracks. You would continue to go off in your own direction. And I think you get a bonus, I think, if you get all the way over to the west. There's like the Western Link or something. But yeah, there was nowhere near the interaction on that map than there was on the England-Wales map because you're all so closely knit. The cities are really close.
And I really liked the interaction. Mm. I thought that was a great way for four of us around the table to just have a really tight, close game. And it came down to one victory point. So it was a close, yes, close, close game. I think it's pretty fair to say that the best captain, train driver person won.
Rail Baron.
Rail Baron, yes. He controlled London, and that made a big difference to the final score. And
well, particularly because he then revealed his Rail Baron card, which said he got 2 points for every connection out of London for a maximum of four?
Four links, which was 8 victory points from, I remember.
Yeah.
And I remember it quite well because that was me.
Was I think most of the other cards, so my card was I think I got 6 points if I managed to connect, I think it was Bristol to York and Leeds, which was sort of quite a distance on the track. The other thing we didn't mention was there is a little chart off on the side of the board where if you can join certain cities, you get bonus points. Now, it must be said, we didn't do a very good job of that.
No.
I claimed one. It was the highest scoring one.
And it was the very last action that you did, which got you 7 points.
It was a bit of a consolation, like I can't really get many points out of cubes. And I had a look and thought, well, if I use all my three turns to build two more links, I can get that 7 points. It's the best I can do on that last turn.
Yeah, and that's where the last couple of rounds are going to be, is just mathing out the best possible
options. Yeah, yeah.
But look, this game is fantastic. For a game that is, I don't even know when the original version, which was it Age of Steam or Railway Tycoon that came out 100 million years ago? This version, I think we played, is a 2009 version.
Yeah, so originally came out as Railroad Tycoon, which was sort of trying to build on that, I think it was Microprose video game, which I actually remember playing whoop, whoop, with all the sound effects and everything. Then it was, I think they lost the copyright or the right to use that name, and then it became Railways of the World. Now, it is quite similar to, I think it's Age of Steam. I always get this mixed up, which is also a game that Martin Wallace has been involved in, which that's then had a sort of more streamlined version called Steam. I've played Steam in an app. I don't know if I've seen the board of Steam apart from in the app. In the app, it's quite plain. Whereas this map, look, maybe the colour palette isn't gorgeous, but it's a lovely map.
I think for a game that's 10 years old.
Yeah, look, it looks quite nice.
It could certainly, I mean, it's having 10-year anniversary. So anyway, I really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, great.
I didn't initially like Russian Railroads when I played it the first time,
mm-hmm.
and that game grew on me. This game, for a train game, I'll happily sit down and play it again because mechanically it's actually quite simple to play. there's a great satisfaction in watching your train empire move out in all directions, because every time you place that track, you get to put this red train or whatever on there. It's great.
And to me, as I said, the reason why I think it's the sort of the trainiest of games is you're more focused on the track building and the delivery of cubes than you are on, for example, owning shares in a railway. Now, we played a game, and I can't for the life of me remember the name of it, Garth, at it was a Queen game, a little bit similar to this, but you were just basically, you were building track, but you didn't have your own railroad. You bought shares in railroads, and then that railroad, then you spent that railroad's money to extend your track, and you got points for sort of extending your track, extending your line. Mm. And that is much like... I think not Age of Steam, but once you start to get into the 18, what they call the 18XX games, and I think 1836 Railroads and Robber Barons or something it's called, is the sort of the big, if there is such a thing as a beginner one, is the beginner one of those. And there's so many 18XX games. Now, I would like to try one day, but it just seems to take that level of complication much further. And there is a part of the England and Wales expansion that introduces shares and can make this version be quite a bit like that, where you don't have your own, you know, there's the different coloured trains, but they're not owned by players, they're owned by companies that you invest shares in. So you can invest in different rail lines, and then you can spend that company's money to do the same thing as you're doing. To me, as I said, that's fun, but it's a bit more number crunchy, whereas I just love the traininess of this as it is.
That's right, and for a game that is this big, it takes up a lot of table space, you look at it and you go, oh, my God, this is daunting. You start the game and it's so slow. Yeah. You're making $4, but you're having to spend $3 just paying back your bonds. You go, how the hell is this going to go on? It speeds up, so it is like that locomotive. It is a very slow grind at the start, but you will be speeding at the end. So that's Railways of the World. Martin Wallace, great game. The Dice Men really approve of it for a trainy train game. Ooh. Well, that was The Cruel Sea with Joyce hashtag 2, or Joyce number 2.
Yeah.
I'm not a millennial, so I don't really work in hashtags. Here with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with just Mark and just Garth, because Leon is just working. So, hello, Leon. I'm very happy, though, that Leon is working, it must be said, because he sent us a little message.
Oh, I could not believe that.
10 kilos of chocolate for $10.
Oh, no.
I've ordered one.
And the fact that it's so cheap because it's going out of date. What was it, in a month?
Yeah, who knows?
But you've got to get through 10 kilos in a month.
I'm working on it.
I picked a perfect time to go on a very restrictive calorie diet, didn't I, Garth?
So anyway, thanks in advance, Leon. But Mark, you got some news for us. Some
sure do, Garth. Now, the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, have announced their nominees for induction into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Now, I've talked, I think, maybe the last couple of years about the National Museum of Play, about how they have this induction into the Hall of Fame every year. Some of their, I think they've been doing it for about 25, 30 years. Some of their past inductees have included the Atari 2600. Oh, so many fond memories. Candyland, Clue, Dungeons and Dragons, The Game of Life, Jigsaw Puzzles, The Frisbee, Monopoly, Scrabble, Twister, and last year's inductee was the Wiffle Ball.
Oh.
So exciting. So the nominees this year, of interest to gamers, so there's quite a few of them, but they include Chutes and Ladders, which we know as Snakes and Ladders.
Correct.
The Magic 8 Ball. Chances say no. Masters of the Universe. Pinball,
yep.
Tic-tac-toe, Tickle Me Elmo. Elmo, I like that one.
Oh,
You Know, and Chalk.
Oh, wow.
So it's going to be interesting to see which one of those, and there's a couple of other ones that are not of interest to us, get picked.
Okay.
Look, if you're interested in investigating more about the Toy Hall of Fame, you can go to www.toyhalloffame.org.
So what's your pick?
Out of all that, they have so many of those, you know, games we mentioned. I don't know that Chutes and Ladders is going to get in there. Whereas, if you ask me, Pinball. Okay. Pinball deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Do you know when they're being announced?
Especially the Kiss pinball.
Oh, you're a fan of that one,
aren't
you?
I am a fan of the Kiss pinball.
The Gene Simmons one?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think it's about a month or so. And look, I'm sure I'll come back and let everyone know, because they'll be dying to know. Now, I've got an Australian connection in the news this week. AEG has announced Scorpius Freighter. It's designed by Matt Dunstan with David Short, and it's going to have a pre-release. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I guess they're going to show it there at Essen Spiel this year. Now, in Scorpius Freighter, you are a rebellious freighter captain smuggling goods and information to thwart the oppressive government. You can recruit crew from the back alley brute to the elite educated. They are the best at what they do. You can customize your ships, outfit your standard sanctioned freighter with hidden goods and an upgraded cockpit, and you can smuggle, of course. Now, to me, this sounds a lot of fun. It made me think of, did you ever play Wing Commander, Garth? The Wing Commander video
games?
Yes,
I did, actually, yes.
Did you ever play the one that I thought was the best, Privateer? I think it came out after Wing Commander 3,
mm-hmm.
and Wing Commander 3 was the one with Mark Hamill that had the animated videos.
Yes, I remember that.
And Privateer was, you are basically a privateer, so you could take official jobs, you could take unofficial jobs, and it was like a sandbox world. You could just go wherever you... There was a storyline, but you could pretty much go wherever you liked. I love that game. This sounds a bit like that in a board game form. Matt Dunstan didn't mention this one at all when I talked to him, so it's quite a surprise.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's working with David Short and not with Brett Gilbert. So keep an eye out for that one at Essen.
And if it's AEG, there's a fair chance it'll come to Kickstarter,
exactly.
I reckon.
Now, an interesting piece of news here. The Gamma, the Game Association Manufacturers of America, something similar. So it's people who produce games, all the companies that produce games, and they have the big Gamma trade show. So the Gamma board of directors have released a statement in which they formally censure Stephen Brassard, who is their president.
Oh, wow.
For his inadvisable actions at Gen Con, specifically his decision to ignore the Gen Con security staff's demands that he present his badge and instead to push physically past them into the Gen Con exhibit hall. Now, I did hear of this, but I didn't really hear who it was. It was just there was a lot of kerfuffle at Gen Con. Now, the organization also strongly urged Brassard to complete an anger management course,
wow,
the statement said. Brassard's actions led to his expulsion from Gen Con, did you know? And a security guard, photos of whom showed bruises, she said were inflicted in the confrontation, actually filed a police report.
Yeah, wow.
Brassard released a statement apologising for the incident, and he promised to do better.
There you go. It's one of those...
That's a pretty big deal.
Don't you know who I think I am?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Let's get back to the games.
Yeah.
So Wizards of the Coast, what do you think they're going to make, Garth?
Some magic stuff?
Or
D&D?
Yeah. So they're going to release a fast-paced Dungeons & Dragons card game called Dungeon Mayhem. It's coming out on November 16th. Now, players take the role of one of four quirky characters.
Hey.
You've got a barbarian, Sutha the Skull Crusher, a paladin, a rogue, and a wizard. The battle to bring home the biggest share of treasure in the dungeon. Now, each character has a unique deck of special cards, and it's a 15-minute card game designed by two guys I've never heard of, Jordan Comer and Roscoe Wetlaufer. I did have a quick look on BGG. They've been involved in a few projects of licensed properties, okay, where they've been, you know, one of three or four designers. So that's a quick little 15-minute D&D game. That'll be fun. They're also releasing, you're not going to believe this one, Garth, just in time for Halloween, Axis and Allies and Zombies.
What?
It's a new take on the iconic World War II strategy board game. Now, each player will command one of the major powers, joining either the Axis or the Allies, and players will fight for victory against the opposing faction, but also against a terrifying new foe, zombies.
Mm.
So this game will have streamlined gameplay, curveballs like chainsaw tanks and zombie mind control rays, and a zany storyline, apparently. Will players survive the onslaught or succumb to the zombie uprising?
And are the zombies a player or an NPC?
Apparently not. No, apparently they're like an NPC. So when I read Axis and Allies and Zombies, I thought I'd misread it.
I can understand that.
Interesting to see how it goes. Now, WizKids, and I'm presuming that they are in some way associated to Wizards of the Coast. I'm sure they are. They're releasing an expansion for their board game based on the sci-fi series The Expanse.
Oh, okay.
Which is very disappointing to me because our friend Aiden sold his copy of The Expanse.
Yeah, well, it did need, I think, a little bit more to it.
Well, this will expand a space opera adventure with 5 new modules that can be added to the base game in any combination. It's called The Expanse Doors and Corners. It introduces leaders, new tech, resource tokens, proto-molecule, and variable setup. So leaders can add to fleets and increase their influence. New tech mixes up the powers and offers players 3 choices when it's earned. Resource tokens can be spent to pay your command point cost and add action points to a card or move a player along an initiative track or score bonus points. Proto-molecule is a whole new scoring opportunity. And then variable setup allows fleets and influence to be placed anywhere where the game starts. So I really enjoyed that game. You know, it had a bit of that card play element, like, what's that game we like?
Twilight Struggle.
That one, yeah. But it was a little bit slow, so maybe this will spice it up.
Well, I would like them to just put all of that new stuff and make a second edition and make it look prettier.
Oh, yes.
Because it just doesn't grab you when it's there on the table with cardboard chits for ships that are really tiny and cubes.
All right.
So now, can you make that happen, please?
I don't know. But WizKids, they're busy because they're also going to release a new dexterity game set in the Star Trek universe. This one's coming out in February, designed by Mike Elliott from Thunderstone, and he's also done Star Trek Fleet Captains. Are you ready for this one, Garth?
I'm sitting down.
Star Trek, conflict in the neutral zone.
Okay.
So it has the Federation and Klingon Empire vying to exploit the resource-rich planets of the neutral zone, where players flick discs representing various starships from the Star Trek universe in an attempt to collect resources and attack other ships. Players bring a ship within range of an energy or command point planet to collect resources, but if the planet is already occupied, the player can attack the rival ship by knocking it off the planet or off the board. Now, it's not always easy, because players can defend an area by putting asteroids in the way. You can counter by buying more ships, making your fleet stronger. And if you successfully remove a rival from a planet, you get 1 command point. First to 10 command points wins.
Oh, so it's conflict 'em up.
Yes, and, you know, a punny name like that, I don't know.
Well, look,
although this flick games seem to be taking off. Like, there's what? SEAL Team Flicks?
Yeah, and I've got Catacombs, the first edition, I think, of that, which is just a dungeon crawl flicking game. And I've played that with my kids, and they really, really like it. You're able to play sort of a little mini campaign over the course of an hour or two, where one player plays the bad things and the other players are playing the various heroes. So it's a bit of fun. Flick 'em Up, of course, is a nice game as well. And Trekkies, they'll buy that.
Of course they will. Now, Tasty Minstrel Games, we love them here. They've been really good to us. We've seen some great games of theirs. They're going to debut Ghosts of the Moor, designed by Michael Kiesling and Wolfgang Kramer at Essenspiel. And I guess, look, there's been heaps of games announced for Essenspiel. We're going to just hear more and more and more about this. This is just one that sort of, you know, took my eye. Kiesling and Kramer, of course, they have designed Spiel des Jahres winners T'Kal and Torres.
Power team.
Yeah, quite a while ago. Ghost of the Moor is a lighter game, though, but there's plenty of tactical thinking that goes on with this set collection adventure game. Players are explorers traversing a haunted swamp on the lookout for treasure. And every turn, players move their pawn forward. If they are the only pawn on a space as they leave, they must pick the tile up behind them. It might contain treasure or possibly a ghost. Ooh. Now, for more mainstream board game news or heavy board game news, we've got an expansion for A Feast for Odin.
Okay.
A Feast for Odin, The Norwegians, offers new ways for players to guide their tribes to victory, including 3 double-sided action boards customized for different numbers of players that adds a 5th column of action spaces for players to choose. 95 new goods tiles.
Oh, God.
Features new animals, new types of food and new equipment for the Vikings, who can now hunt elk, purchase horses, or craft weapons and armor, while the double-sided artisan sheds give players new way to produce goods. And rounding out the expansion are 8 double-sided exploration boards depicting distant cities like Cork, Limerick, and the Isle of Skye, which players can visit or raid. That is adding a heap more to an already busy game.
Is it ever? I'd like to try this again because you and I played it earlier in the year.
Yeah.
At some convention.
On the border.
And it was really, really good, but I still prefer, again, Agricola.
Yeah.
And possibly still Caverna to this. I would like to have another opportunity to play it with more than two.
Yeah.
And again, look, it's one of those games where certainly the more you play it, the more you will understand it, the more you will get better. But yeah, geez, there's a lot going on in that game and a lot of just stuff.
Well, a couple more quick ones. In exciting news for Leon and other wrestling fans, WizKids has announced a multi-year licensing tag team partnership with WWE, which will bring the entertainment's brand superstars to HeroClix, Dice Masters, and some branded board games. Of course, this is going to bring people like John Cena, The Rock, The Undertaker, Roman Reigns, and Charlotte Flair, whoever they are, as well as WWE Hall of Famer Stone Cold Steve Austin and Trish Stratus to WizKids gaming platforms. Products will be available all around the world, released next year.
Okay, that's it. That
and
cool.
Finally, a news for fans of Wolfgang Wosch. Remember him?
Yes, he designed almost all of the nominated games this year.
That's right, the Quacks, the Mind. He's got a game called Fuji. Now, this made me think of you, Garth, on the radio talking about Japan and me watching Dark Tourist about Mount Fuji. But this, it's a cooperative dice game where players are a group of adventurers hoping to visit Japan's Mount Fuji. But just as they arrive, because this is bound to happen, the volcano erupts.
Well, it is a dormant volcano, one of the three holy mountains in
and
Japan.
And spewing deadly lava everywhere, so players must secretly and simultaneously roll their dice behind screens and work together to navigate their way safely back to the village. Players can only move to their terrain if they match a requirement better than their fellow players, so communication is key in this game. So it sounds like fun.
Should be.
And Wolfgang Wosch, he's just hidden everything out of the park at the moment. So we'll wait and see what that one. I haven't got a date on that one.
That's okay.
Garth, that is all the news I have for tonight.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. Now, I do request that you have a Kickstarter update for us soon because Kickstarter is going off at the moment with the number of campaigns
You spoke last week about this being a hot time for Kickstarters, that's
yes.
for sure.
So there's a few, including a Kevin Wilson dungeon crawl that might surprise you.
Kevin Bloody Wilson?
Not Kevin Bloody Wilson. So we are the Dice Men Cometh. It's Edge Radio 99.3 FM, and here is your song.
Hey, Garth.
Yes.
Here we are driving along to our latest game night, and you know what I love to do when I drive around?
Well, I do remember the last time you drove and almost...
Get out of the way!
That's right. You almost killed us, remember?
That's right. Well, it's probably because I was slightly distracted, because I was listening to a podcast. I like to listen to podcasts when I'm driving.
Yep.
It takes my mind off my day at work. It lets me catch up with politics or board games or all sorts of things.
Well, the funny thing is I was actually listening to a podcast on my walk into work, which I was doing earlier.
Yeah.
And I found out that there are TV actors who get paid in excess of $20 million a year.
What?
And look, all they're doing is creating little half-hour episodes once a week. Now, I happen to know that as Australia's leading podcast on board gaming, we do a lot more work than half an hour a week, and all we're asking is if anyone's got a spare dollar kicking around, just jump on a Patreon and throw it our way.
Yeah, and look, I know myself. I support a couple of podcasts because I really believe in what they're doing. And as you said, a dollar or $2 or $5 or $10 or hundreds of thousands of dollars. I mean, you know, it's greatly appreciated by the creators of those podcasts,
look,
that's for sure.
We'll even take Monopoly money. Just don't tell Leon that. And what we're also going to do as a little bit of a thank you, and we're running this in, I guess, partnership as well with the Campaigner magazine, is any new Patreon backer will get a little Dice Man gift. Don't you reckon that's nice?
That is so generous of those Dice Men.
So we're not just creating quality content every week. We're also going to give you a signature Dice Man dice, of which there's only a few of these around now, so it's limited to the first 20 backers.
So jump onto Patreon, check out the Dice Man Cometh. We'd love your support. Any amount you can afford It's all greatly appreciated. We put the resources back into the show, helping us to travel to game conventions so we can interview people and you can hear all the cons that you're missing out on, and maybe you'll get to go there later.
I know. Doesn't that sound amazing?
It sounds worthwhile. Get out of the way, you idiot, young person!
Well, that was Josh Pike with Middle of the Hill. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio at 99.3 FM. Mark.
Garth.
What have you been playing lately?
Well, I have been introducing you and a couple of our other friends and my son and my partner to a little dice drafting game called Sagrada.
Oh, you mean that game that was super duper hot a few months ago?
Yeah. I remember Leon and I were actually introduced to this one at an event held on the border every year in sort of the middle of the year where we play board games. A lovely young woman called QC from Melbourne, she introduced us to this game, and I hadn't actually played it again until I bought it at Area 52.
There you go.
Just a couple of months ago. It was designed, it came out in 2017, designed by Adrian Adamescu and Daryl Andrews. It plays 1 to 4 players, and the playtime 30 to 45 minutes, which we found that was pretty accurate when we played it.
Yeah, well, there was three of us sitting around the table, and we were taught the game by you and played the game, and I lost the game. Or within that sort of 35 to 40 minute
That's break. Right. And this one's produced by Floodgate Games, but there's a million producers producing it all around the world. Now, Sagrada means holy or sacred in Spanish, but more importantly, the Sagrada Familia, or the sacred family or holy family, is a very famous church in Barcelona designed by Gaudi.
Have you been there?
No, I have not been to Barcelona.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and of course it has some, I guess, amazing stained glass art, because in this game you are an artist competing with fellow artists to create the most beautiful stained glass windows in the Sagrada Familia. Now, your glass pieces in the stained glass window are represented by crystally coloured dice, which have a colour and a what they refer to as a shade, which is really to do with the pips on the die. So a lighter shade is a low-value pip, and a darker shade is a high-value pip. Now, each round, you will draft dice from a pool of dice. Now, the player's turn it is pulls out two dice for every person that's playing plus one extra, rolls them, and then you will go around in drafting, taking a dice and placing it in your little stained glass window. Now, you have these beautiful little player mats that are very ornate with a picture of a stained glass window, but you're only really worried about this 5x4, 6x5 grid. I can't remember. That was 6. Yeah, no, maybe it's 5x4 grid, where very cleverly you have these little sliding cards. Now, all the cards are double-sided. And at the start of the game, you will take two of these cards. So you've got a choice of four basic sort of styles, pictures of stained glass window you're trying to make. You'll pick the one you want. You'll slide it into your player board. And then you'll be placing your dice onto those little cards. Now, some of the spots will have a color that you can only place that color of dice. Some of the spots will have a shade indicating you can only place that number of dice. And then other spots will be blank. Now, the basic rules of placement when you are placing dice is the first dice, dice, the first square little thing with pips on it.
It's a cube.
Yep. That's right. Has to go somewhere around the outside. Every other dice you place has to be adjacent either orthogonally or diagonally to that first die. You can't place coloured dice orthogonally adjacent to the same coloured dice. You can't place numbered dice orthogonally adjacent, no matter what colour, to that same number. They're basically the rules for placement.
That's it.
You're trying to fill your little card in so that you can put the dice in the spots that have to be certain things and then fill in the rest. You're also trying to, surprisingly, score points. How do you score points in this game?
That's the bit I didn't actually do too well in.
Well, you have three ways. Each person will have a private objective. That will just show, it's on a card, that will just show the colour of dice. And for that colour of dice, they score the pips. So obviously if you have green, you're trying to get as many green dice in your window, still make your pattern, but obviously if you can get higher value ones, you will get more points. Then there are three public objectives, and they could be things like you get 1 point for every diagonally adjacent die that's the same colour. So you're basically trying to make diagonals of the same colour. You might have dice that says if you can get five different colours in a row across, you get a certain amount of points. Or four different colours in a row down, you get a certain amount of points. Four different shades, or five, same with shades. And there's a few sort of strange ones. But it just, I guess that provides a fair bit of variability. You also have these favour tokens, which are glass beads. You have them because at the end of the game, they're worth 1 point each, and you start with a certain amount. Each of your window cards has a number of dots indicating how difficult it is from three up to six. So if you play a six difficulty window, you start with six favour tokens. But what you mostly use these for is to use the tool cards. So there are three tool cards, and they'll basically be rule breakers. So you might be able to flip a die over or a dice. You might be able to swap two dice. You might be able to take one of the drafted dice and replace it with one of the non-drafted dice, or move dice after you've placed them, which you normally can't do. You might even be able to break those placement rules that I mentioned where, for example, you can ignore colour placement rules or ignore shade placement rules. So they're little rule breakers. The sort of the twist on this is the first person who wants to use a particular tool, they have to spend one favour token. The second person then has to spend, to use the same tool, has to spend two favour tokens. So it gets a little bit more expensive to use them. If you don't use them, obviously they're worth one victory point. The final scoring is for every spot you don't fill in your window, you lose a victory point. That is basically the game.
It is. And it's a nice, simple, solitary puzzle kind of game for the most part. You're really just focused on your window. However, you do need to keep an eye on your opponents, because those three public objectives are easily able to sort of get a bit of a grasp on how well your opponents are achieving those.
And particularly those ones you can see easily at a glance. Yeah.
Correct. So you're always looking at your own beautiful sort of double thick player board and your window that's progressively getting more colourful, but you just glance over to the opponents every so often and go, oh, hello, I can see that. There's a fair chance Mark's going for this bonus, so if I take the only one colour of the die that he needs to go in that row, I might stuff him up.
Yes, and you usually are able to work out what everyone's private objective is fairly quickly because, oh, Garth, it's like every second die you're placing is a green one.
I know.
You're going for those green sixes quite often. I reckon you're green. Now, Garth, what changes that up a bit? There's a 5-6 player expansion discovered.
Oh, great.
Now, obviously, it introduces two more player boards, more dice, so you've got enough dice, more window patterns, more private objectives, more tools, but it also introduces a private dice pool board.
Ooh.
And so what you do in the when you're playing 5-6 players, and you can play it with less if you've got the expansion, you only have half the number of dice in the bag, and then you have your private dice pool where you have, there's five colours of dice, so you have two of each colour you roll at the start and place on this private dice pool. And at any time, so normally you would take one from the public pool that you draft and one from your private pool. But if you want, you can take more than one. But obviously that means your choices are restricted. So I don't know whether that makes it a little bit more strategic or... I know. The review I saw, the reviewer said, oh, I love this private dice pool. For me, that sort of takes away a bit from the only interactive part of this game.
Well, look, for me, it's a very light game. You play it and it's half an hour and it's a bit of fun. I would certainly choose to play Azul over this.
Yeah.
But in terms of dice manipulation games, I would much rather go and play Role Player. Something a little bit meatier because it is more involved, more tactical and strategic, and in fact the puzzle that you're trying to create in Role Player is just more interesting for me. I think the theme is really good. the fact that you've got a lot of different abilities to manipulate dice that you have achieved and taken from the main pool, I just find that more fun. For a game that is not a hell of a lot longer, it might still play in an hour or so, whereas this is half an hour.
Yeah.
I'd rather spend an hour doing something I'm really find interesting and fun. This is just, oh, I've got a few minutes to kill. Yeah, I'll have a go.
This, for me, has certainly been almost a filler, a quick, light filler. It looks pretty. Maybe that's why I was able to, you know, trick my partner into playing it with me and my son, who, you know, he's a teenager. He doesn't want to play anything that goes too long. So, yeah, look, it's filled a nice little gap for us. It's certainly been quite fun.
Fantastic. And on that note, the Dice Men do have some Dice Men dice burning holes in our dice pockets. So, yes. Look, here's a challenge. Anyone who wants to jump onto iTunes, give us a bit of a review. You just let us know. Send us an email to dicemencometh@gmail.com and we'll flick you a dice, hey?
And look, anyone who's already got a review there, if you want to update it and give us more than 5 stars,
yeah,
if that's possible, give us a yell as well. We won't exclude you.
So this is the end of the show. We are the Dice Men Cometh. I'm Garth.
He's Mark.
We'll have Leon back next week and we'll see you all in a week's time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to another episode of The Dice Men Cometh. Thanks to Area 52, Hobart's best ventilated game store, and more. Find out more on area52.com.au. They support The Dice Men, and you can too, at Patreon, for as little as just $1 per month. It's not a lot to ask for podcasting gold.